Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to the War Room podcast. I'm Jacqueline Witt, professor of strategy at the U.S. Army War College and the War Room podcast editor. Thanks for joining us today. When it comes to foreign policy and national security, policymakers and strategists' relationship to the American public is an important one, but it is not always easy to understand or analyze. In some cases, public opinion can seem to matter a great deal, and it can shape policy and strategic-level decisions. Certainly, the Vietnam anti-war movement, for example, had significant effects on President Johnson's and President Nixon's foreign policies. At other times, political and military leaders, though, might acknowledge public opinion on a topic, but then proceed right along with their own judgment anyway, deeming the public ill-informed about the actual needs of the country. And here we can imagine President Roosevelt in the lead-up to American entry into World War II, right, slowly guiding the country in an unpopular but necessary direction. But these relationships, of course, aren't static, and changes in available technologies and media platforms can sometimes drive public opinion and its expression in unexpected ways. And so leaders have to manage their responses as well. So today, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Samantha Taylor in the studio with me to discuss this important topic. Dr. Taylor earned her PhD in history from the University of Southern Mississippi and is currently at the Naval War College teaching policy analysis for the National Security Affairs Department. She is an expert on U.S. foreign policy in the late Cold War and post-Cold War period, and her work specifically examines the role of ideology and public opinion in shaping American grand strategy. So welcome to Warcast, Samantha.
Hi, and thank you for having me.
Great. So I want to start actually with a story about some emails to President Clinton. And of course, we're talking about President Clinton of the 1990s, right, when email was still a new thing. So tell me about this batch of emails that you found in the archive.
So the first batch of emails that I found in the archive are related to the Bosnian conflict. And there was significant public reaction towards supporting a U.S. intervention in Bosnia out of humanitarian concerns about the ethnic conflict and the ethnic cleansing that was going on. And so this batch of emails I saw was from one particular American citizen who sent the same email every day for a month to President Clinton, urging him to take a stronger, hardline approach to the parties fighting in Bosnia.
Okay, so we have, it's like verbatim the same.
It's verbatim the same. Like
every day for a month.
Every day for a month. Like he copied and pasted, you know, control or command C, and then control and command V, and pasted it and sent it off to the White House every day.
So do we have any response to this email? Does it just go into a file of communications that the White House receives?
I think so. It goes into a file that the White House receives, and the way that they sort the emails, based on the fact that even though it was received every day for a month, I don't believe that the administration gave it the priority to move it up the ladder to get a response. At least I didn't find a response in the Clinton archive.
Great. So is there any sense of why he stopped, or anything? Do we have any speculation, or is it just like this blip in time where we see this communication?
I think in a way it's both a blip in time, but also the availability that email provided. I can't imagine someone taking the time every day for a month to handwrite a letter, the same letter, mm-hmm. to a president and sending it off to them, paying the postage, putting in the mail,
right,
doing that every day. Whereas an email, you can sit in a computer, type it up, copy and paste it if you feel the urge to resend it every month. And
right.
I think that if you're doing that in a time of email first coming out and you're not getting a response after a month, then perhaps you don't feel that there's a need to continue sending it.
Right, because it maybe still feels like one-way communication, like it's maybe not going anywhere,
right,
or something. So I think that's really interesting because the speed with which you can fire off an email is obviously much faster. Like you said, it's less work.
Yeah.
Right? Like I have a postcard that I still need to send to my mother from like two months ago. So I should get to the post office. But I send her emails, you know, pretty frequently. So that's sort of one aspect of these emails. We have people sending things constantly and communicating. Now, there's another set, which is a little bit different, that you also found, right?
Right. So these are emails within the Clinton administration. And these emails are in response to the Haitian crisis and Bush and Clinton's decision to go in and have a military intervention to restore the democratic government to Haiti. And this intervention was highly unpopular among the American public. And so we see that in the uprun to Operation Uphold Democracy,
which is 1994,
okay, that Clinton goes on this strong public relations campaign to promote or get public support behind Operation Uphold. And during this, he's calling on America's tradition of democracy, that we need to go in and support and restore this democratic government, because we ourselves struggled when we first had our democratic, installed our democratic government, to protect it and to enlarge it around in our country. And so he was promoting these ideas. And so the Clinton administration is keeping a check on public reaction. And in his final push for the to get public opinion behind his Haitian intervention, he goes and he has a public address to the public. And AOL, which in the 1990s was the big email client, told their clients to watch the speech either online or to watch it on television, and that they provided a link to send emails directly to the Clinton administration on their response to his speech. And there's this email from the person in charge of the email database for the White House, who is complaining about AOL's decision to encourage the American public to watch the speech, use the link, and to respond, because they got, they went from 15,000 emails to 150,000 emails in the per day for 4 days in the period after his speech.
Wow. So that, I mean, that really tells us something about the, even the power of the very early internet, right? When most Americans aren't connected, and AOL, I mean, AOL only comes online in like 1993. So it's still pretty new, but that's a massive increase in communication. And again, you imagine the ease with which people can send their responses. Do you have any sense of that? So that's a sense of the number. So that's in the hundreds of thousands of emails. Were you able to get a sense of what the emails said or the content of any of those?
So based on the statistics that the Clinton administration themselves did on the emails, they were overwhelmingly still opposed to the Haitian intervention in Haiti, that the United States didn't need to be invading. A lot of people referred to it as an invasion of Haiti. They said, we don't need to be invading Haiti, that the United States doesn't have a responsibility to go in and help restore the Haitian democracy. And so there was this clear disconnect between the American public's version of U.S. responsibility for promoting and spreading democracy compared to Clinton's. In the end, it didn't matter. Clinton still went ahead with the intervention and attempted to restore the Haitian democracy in 94.
Right. So I think that's an interesting case where we see public opinion and the expression of that public opinion very clearly, but the administration clearly choosing to do, to do its own thing and to do what it believes is the right call. Do you think that the administration was frustrated by knowing what the public opinion was? Would it have been easier for them to go along with this decision if they hadn't received hundreds of thousands of emails?
I get the sense from the emails and the records from the Clinton administration that they were not pleased that the American public remained opposed to the intervention. However, because Clinton believed so strongly that democracy had to be promoted and that it should be restored in Haiti, that he was going to go ahead along those lines and restore and do the intervention, even though public opinion was so far against it.
It seems to me to also tell us an interesting story about the role that American businesses will play in sort of shaping foreign policy and the way that technologies will shape the expression of that foreign policy, because I believe you said AOL just did this sort of on its own, like unprompted and it wasn't a coordinated effort from the White House. Now we would be, I guess, used to seeing the White House sort of inviting responses through their own channels and through their own managing their own profiles on the media.
Yes.
So what do we think, if we expand this out a little bit broader, what do we think this tells us about the relationship between, say, technology and media, and the sort of strategic environment that we found in the post-Cold War world?
So I think that if we look at technology and media at this time period in the 1990s, we see that this is the emergence of the 24-hour news network. We see this is where CNN got its heyday. I mean, it did the 24-hour broadcast of the Persian Gulf War and became the 24-hour cable news channel that everybody could watch if you had cable television. And that was possible because of embedded reporters. It was possible because of improvements in satellite communications that made all this possible. And with also the spread of the internet from the government to the domestic sphere to the public, we see that now there's more communication becomes easier. But as communication becomes easier, it also means that the flow back and forth between policymakers and the public gets more complex.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see more of the nuances in public opinion. Most of us agreed that the public is not very interested in foreign policy unless it directly affects the United States.
Okay.
But at the same time, those that remain interested have this improved accessibility to administrations to express their opinions. Because before, it was like if you had an opinion about the news, you sent a letter to the editor.
Okay.
If you wanted it to get, like, not just a private reach, or you were didn't want it to get lost
right,
in the administration.
Right, that was a public forum would have right. been to send it to a newspaper or to a periodical, perhaps.
Right. And so we see that with the advent of mass media and the introduction of social media, that suddenly there's additional ways to get that public opinion out, to get that perception of what is good for U.S. interests or not. And in the post-Cold War period, when it was so hard to see, look at the world and see what was a direct threat to U.S. interests and what wasn't, it gave policymakers both a better view and a more complicated view of where American citizens saw America's role in the world. Because we have policy experts thinking that this is the U.S. hegemony. We have this period where we can kind of spread U.S. image right. around the world. And we have American citizens not seeing that, but seeing it as this is supposed to be the period where we can have peace.
Where there's a peace dividend.
There's a peace dividend.
Yeah. So really different views about American grand strategy that start to emerge from the public and from the policymaking world. If we think about this broad relationship between public opinion and media and technology and foreign policy, do you think that the sort of platform changes? So if we think about the move from right newspapers to broadcast network news to cable news and CNN to like the early days of the internet to now where social media sort of seems to be a predominant paradigm, do you think that those technological changes are actually driving or shaping public opinion in important ways?
I would say that yes, they are. And I think we can look at to the recent debates going on with fake news and international interference in public opinion. The idea that agents or non-state actors are going out and spreading misinformation that the American public is taking in and using to reinform their understanding of America's position in the world and what American foreign policy should be. And that when we look at this technology in that role, it's so much quicker to spread so much right. more of it.
Because spreading disinformation isn't a new
no.
thing that right that clandestine agencies would do, but the ubiquity and the speed with which yeah. they can do it on the internet does seem to me to be different.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays you can hide where you're from spreading this information. You can make it appear that you are an American citizen spreading this story, like the story about the guy that went and shut up the pizzeria because of the story about it being, child trafficking for the Clinton administration. But I think it also means that we as American citizens also have to reevaluate how we look at social media and how we look at the information that we're getting mm-hmm. at social media to inform our knowledge of foreign policy and world events.
Right.
Because it is so much harder nowadays to make that separation.
That distinction. And I think one of the, I saw a study recently about the spread of fake news or false news on Twitter in particular, and we want to sort of blame bots for a lot of this, but it turns out that it was mostly people, real users doing the spreading of false information, and it says something important about how information spreads, how what we're inclined to share or retweet or whatever it is, and I think it does require some real vigilance to make sure that people are responsible sort of users of the media. Even as it offers us great benefit, it also has some pretty significant risks, right?
It does. And what's interesting, though, is that we tend to say that what's happening now is so different from the past, but this is kind of the negative downside to so much interconnectivity and interdependence created by the spread of technology, starting with the internet. And when we're looking at foreign policy in particular in media, it's not just the public. There are stories out there of policymakers themselves looking at these fake news stories and being convinced by them and making decisions off of them. And so I don't think it's just the public that needs to be more aware of that. I think it's also policymakers. And it's one of the signs of society not keeping up with technological changes.
Sure. And we also have, we also have a different sort of more polarized, more partisan environment, more specificity in terms of websites that people might visit. Again, when there was newspapers and broadcast television, everybody was sort of watching the same things, but, your Facebook feed or your Twitter feed might look very different from mine, might look very different from someone out in Iowa, might look different from somebody who's out in Honolulu, right?
True.
Just based on who your social networks are and who your contacts are. So everybody's not seeing the same things anymore. Do you see ways in which policymakers are sort of using these technological changes and the changes in media platforms to shape how they think about public opinion and foreign policy?
I think that a lot of policymakers are still coming to terms with these advances that are made, because suddenly social media makes it a two-way conversation. And it's not just you speaking through the television to the public and the public responding with emails or through letters to the editor. We now have the ability to do in-the-moment live discussions about policy decisions that are being made. We were talking about one of Obama's speeches and how he was streaming it live, and that at the time, this was before Facebook Live, when you can do the instant comments and there'd be millions of comments on it. But the idea that at the time when he was doing it, that you could get a few comments and you could really see this discourse going on in the public about where they felt the policy decisions were going. And even though it's a speech and he can't really respond off script to those comments, when you have now Facebook Live and you do have the ability to do these actual...
Right, and the reactions.
And the instant reactions, you can kind of see people trying to make those conversations in real time. And I think that for policymakers, it's going to become a bigger avenue that we're going to have to be faced to adapt to and to use if we want to make our cases for the public. Because the public is less and less inclined to watch these speeches or these broadcasts on the news television as they are to watch it on Facebook, where they can have that instant response or that instant commentation with the policymakers. The public, because of social media, no longer wants to just be the receiving audience. They want to be active participants.
Right, interactive, and they want to... And the feedback is so immediate there, right? You sort of get the heat maps that you would get with the turning of the dials about whether you're liking something or not at any given moment in a speech, that sort of old analysis would do, but you can have it in that real time and then respond to it. And I think you can see how wary some politicians are for interacting in this way, but they also, this like draw that they need to do it, but it's also a little bit terrifying to do it because you can never tell what's going to happen.
Right.
Who's going to, it's much less controlled. You can't show, you can't control access.
Right.
In the same way that you could to an in-person event or something. So let's talk really briefly. Let's speculate a little bit more, about Twitter and social media. And what do we think that historians 20 years from now, 30, 50 years from now, looking back on this sort of moment in time where we have a president who is very active on Twitter, the president's use of Twitter has been roundly sort of analyzed and critiqued and applauded, and you know, there's every response under the sun to it. What do we think historians might be saying about our own time in the future?
I think they're going to be more interested or more questioning about social understandings of social media at this time and social mores of social media at this time. They're going to be like, how did most Americans think that a president using Twitter was actually something that was presidential or not? But I also think they're going to look at these tweets and also look at their role in shaping Trump's foreign policy. And does it help further explain Trump's foreign policy? Did it weaken Trump's foreign policy, in particular, his ability to negotiate with U.S. allies in the international world? Mm-hmm. And so I think that when historians look back at this period in time, Twitter is going to be in an interesting place because there's still this debate going on about how to preserve his tweets because they fall under presidential statements. And as we know, on Twitter, you can delete something from your own Twitter page, but if someone else has copied it and retweeted it,
screenshots and all of that,
you know, they're still possible to be found. And I think that as a historian, when we look at these and we look at his scripted statements and we look at statements from his own policy administrators, it, in a way, the tweets give us a better understanding of Trump's own, and will give us possibly a better understanding of Trump's own understandings and inner thinkings about foreign policy or other matters of state.
Right. No, I think this is going to be a really interesting challenge for historians to figure out how Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all of the other things, like Snapchat and all the others, right, fit into this world where we're used to dealing in documents and official memos and speeches and, you know, advisory papers and things like that. So I think it'll be a brave new world for sure. Maybe if the two of us are still working in the field 30 years from now, right, fingers crossed. We'll be on the leading edge of this.
Yeah.
So thanks, Samantha, for joining me today. This is Jackie Witt signing off for War Room.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu, and have a great day.